Hi, welcome back to Bookish. My guest this week is architect Barbara Bestel. I was thrilled to get to meet her. If you live in LA, you have probably been in one of Barbara's exquisitely designed buildings. She is an architect based here and the principal of Bestel Architecture. And her spaces include Intelligentsia Cafe in Silver Lake, the Claire V store in Silver Lake, Beats by Dre, the headquarters for that, Pitfire Pizza in Culver City, which my children have undoubtedly desecrated on more than one occasion, the beautifully redesigned Beechwood Cafe in Beechwood Canyon under the Hollywood sign. These are all spaces that if you live in LA, you've probably been in and probably noticed the colorful, bright use of space and light and geometry and just splashes of beautiful color. Barbara was kind enough to give me an hour of her time at her glorious offices in Silver Lake. So I hope you look forward to the interview. I loved hearing her talk about architecture and how literature has influenced her as an architect. It was a really interesting point of view and not one I'd ever considered. And I hope it's as illuminating for you as it was for me. Barbara, thank you so much for doing this. I'm so delighted to have you on the podcast. I really am. It was so fun when our mutual friend Nancy, who was also going to be a guest, I think I interview her next week, when she came back from having met you and couldn't wait to get in touch with me saying, I've met your new guest. So I'm just thrilled and delighted. I'm such a huge fan of your work. So it's really, really exciting to see you and know you and get your books and things. So thank you for doing it.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm extremely happy to be here. I think this is the first podcast I may have ever done. So
is it? Oh, good. I saw you done some stuff for KCRW and things. You've done some radio interviews, but not podcasts.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Certainly not about like interesting things like books.
Have you always been a reader?
Yeah, I think I remember reading things like I like to read series. I remember in third grade getting into the Wizard of Oz books, of which there are perhaps 40, you know, and they're kind of written from the, I don't know, the 20s and 30s or something.
But are they really that many? I had no idea.
Yeah, strange universe and, I don't know, probably questionable given today's politics and things, but at the time, it was sort of like this fun, I mean, I had a turtle that I named Ozma, because Ozma is sort of a main character. Anyhow, but I was always reading a lot, and that was sort of, it's still probably it's probably my self-care is like having time to read. Mm-hmm. And if I'm on vacation, most of that is spent like reading by the beach or something.
Mm-hmm. Do you make time for it when you work? I mean, you're working all the time, but.
I don't make time for reading really during the day. I kind of read articles in the morning and then I read books at night usually. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm one of those horrible Facebook posters who's posting all kinds of articles that aren't necessarily political and more esoteric and nobody really likes them. <That's
okay. laughs> I think that's okay. That's interesting that you talk about reading as self-care. I did an interview earlier this week and we were talking about exactly this, and I was saying at the risk of my repeating myself on the podcast that I've taken myself off Instagram and Twitter. So it was my New Year's resolution just to see what it did to my nervous system as much as anything else. And I have found that it has exponentially increased my ability to concentrate. That it's radical and immediate, the shift. And as someone who has read consistently throughout my life, I didn't realize how impacted it had been. I just noticed and thought that it was a combination of having two young children and being a mother and, you know, working and all the rest of it. But I think I realized that it was, that there was a correlation between social media and an ability to really digest and hold and stay for what a novel asks of you. And that felt like self-care. But you draw that line so immediately. And I don't think I had until lately that it was really important for the good of one's soul to immerse in that way, I think.
Yeah. Well, I remember I used to spend years at the shrink saying I wanted to lead a more contemplative life because I tend to lead a very busy life. Mm-hmm. But I guess I've realized that like it's unlikely I'll kind of go off and do a 1 week, you know, silent retreat. But in a way, reading is kind of, you know, something that I just find it very not soothing in like a opioid kind of way, but it's sort of a Yeah, and as you say, the immersion, I think, is really good in the story. And I have that horrible thing sometimes where I read a book that isn't very good, and I find it hard to just throw something out the window. And so it's just like this torture. I'm always complaining to my husband, like, oh, God, this book is terrible.
And you make yourself finish it?
I just kind of need to know what happened. You know, whatever. It's terrible. But then I feel, I'm like, how badly can I say this book is on Goodreads or something like that? Not that I really even do that, but it's kind of funny. But so I'm wary of, you know, I don't just read any old thing.
Right, right.
I don't want to get stuck with this.
Yeah. Who do you take a recommendation from? Do you use Goodreads or do you use friends? Or?
No, I think friends usually. Sometimes, actually, probably the book review. I read the New York Times book review and the.
You do.
The New York Review of Books a lot.
Yeah.
And then sometimes The Guardian, you know, like that's more like from, and then social media sometimes, mm-hmm. like on Facebook, some friends of mine will post books that they like.
Mm-hmm.
I have a client who we trade book recommendations mm-hmm. back and forth.
Yeah.
It's a little haphazard, but I do find it's like mining, right? Once you find an author that you like and hopefully they have a nice, you know, body of work, and then you're good for, like, you know, 2 months just going through
I
that.
I agree,
you know?
Yeah. I never used to be that. I used to be much more esoteric and much more, I read one great novel by someone and then that would be fine. I'd move on. But I find as I've got older, I want to know everything they wrote. I want to dig out their last short story just in case it's, you know, right. some gem that I've missed.
Right.
Did you come from a bookish family? Were you readers, all of you?
Yeah, I think, well, every academic family, so I have professor parents and...
Professors of what?
Anthropology. My father's an anthropologist and my mom was language, although she ended up being more an administrator in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
She's from Germany. She still does read a fair amount, actually. She runs a Booker Prize book club, I think.
Oh, really?
She still goes to, and she's always giving me the cast-offs, you know.
That's fun.
And then my dad is, I guess he was bookish, but I don't know that he would have been a big fiction reader, but although I guess that's where like one of the books on my things came from. That
which one is his?
P.G. Woodhouse. Well, P.G. Woodhouse is like my dad's entire branch of the family was like P.G. Woodhouse ish.
Oh, really?
That was the Bester lingua franca, frankly. And so I had I myself had a P.G. Woodhouse lending library that I created in sixth grade, I think.
No
Seventh
way.
Grade where I,
so
I would
wait.
Lend out P.G. Woodhouse to members of my family. I had made little library cards for it. Someone, I think maybe my grandfather had deeded me his collection of hardcovers.
Of the whole lot?
Oh. Well, a whole bunch that he had, yeah. Maybe
really?
His duplicates or something. So I kind of lined them up on a shelf and had my little P.G. Woodhouse.
That's adorable. P.G. Woodhouse. So the book you picked was Code of the Worcesters, which was published in 1938, which is the third novel of the series. I had not known that this man wrote... Woodhouse wrote 35 stories and 10 novels with Bertie and Jeeves in, which is just... staggering amount of output to me. Why do you think Woodhouse was the lingua franca of your family? What chimed with them?
It's hilarious. I mean, it's kind of prose. The prose is hilarious, and it's also it's escapist in that things kind of operate in this parallel universe of like lighthearted, you know, I guess kind of it's nobility or it's pre-war England.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a, you know, it's a land of, like, lords and showgirls and people stealing each other's, like, silver, you know, cow creamer because so-and-so collects the cow creamers. And, you know, it's just, there's always, like, a kind of MacGuffin that is the plot line.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of it's an excuse to just be hilariously droll about things. And so it's very charming and it's very enveloping in a way because it's this sort of whole, you know, lovely world. And I think for me as a kid, it was... I had like a more complicated childhood, and in a way, I think I was like, I just want to live in like a P.G. Woodhouse universe,
right.
Especially at that age. I was like, I'm just going to read this all the time. I think I was living in rural Michigan for a year, and I was like, get me out of here.
Mm-hmm.
So the book was like a really good kind of escape.
Mm-hmm. Do you have siblings?
I have a sister, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did she read them?
She did. I don't know if she went quite as far down the deep end. But it's one of those, it's kind of like Tom Lehrer, like the guy who made these records in the 60s that are kind of like comic piano music that's sort of political but like wordy. Like there's a whole kind of dorky academic humor thing that's kind of part of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that Andrew Cookburn, the super leftist Marxist critic from The Nation, like a British guy, but he wrote like a whole sort of obity thing for P.G. Woodhouse about how great it was. And this is a, you know, stories are just about like nobility and like upper classes and stuff. And it was, you know, it's kind of, I think a lot of people really responded to that. And,
I was just reading I've read Woodhouse and he was someone that my grandfather passionately loved. So I relate to it being something that gets handed down through the family and that becomes a currency that you can use to sort of... My grandpa loved Woodhouse and also Arthur Conan Doyle. So read the Sherlock Holmes. It was an easy way to cross the bridge to talk to grandpa, actually, and to have something sort of in common. And I was just struck by it. It's the first Woodhouse I've had... I think he's the first time he's cropped up on the list. And interesting that, you know, as an American that you would pick such an English and so tied to such a specific period, an author. Right. And I think he does get a raw deal as being just this sort of humorist. And that there is something, particularly in I didn't know about Code of the Woosters. So I was reading about it. And
I think that's one of the best, but they're all kind of great. I mean, but a lot of it's written in America. I mean, he moved to America and it went early. Mm. So he's writing all this stuff kind of I don't know if it was nostalgia. It was just like his world. And, you know, this is a way of using this kind of like language that he liked to use, which is, I mean, if you look at a given line, I wish I had brought one with me, but they're just hysterical. Like, the writing is just hysterical.
I pulled out a line that made me laugh. Well, this actually goes back to the point you were making, which is that he's a political commentator in his brilliant and funny way. And there's this character, the would-be fascist dictator, Roderick Spode.
Roderick Spode.
Exactly. And who's loosely based on Oswald Mosley, who was the fascist at the time. And I love the detail that Spode's followers are called the black shorts because they've run out of colours for the shirts. So they've had to go to shorts. No, but Spode is described as appearing as if nature had intended to make a gorilla and changed its mind at the last moment, which is just fucking brilliant. It really is. It doesn't get better than that. But I was reading a lovely piece in The New Yorker about Woodhouse, and I forget who wrote it. And he drew this lovely analogy, I thought, between saying that Jeeves and Worcester in that relationship is not dissimilar to Peter Pan and Wendy, that Jeeves is a kind of Wendy, mother, nanny, surrogate, and that Bertie is this eternal lost boy who can't grow up and who can't do anything without his sort of attendant in that way. And that I just thought that was it was a tiny comment in it, but I just was so struck by it. I thought it was such a lovely analogy and such a gentle way of looking at this quite hearty, brisk duo that the two of them are. There was something really insightful about seeing them as a lost boy and a Wendy taking care of each other.
Yeah, I mean, I guess or like a kind of, you know, one of these weird buddy pictures with like Eddie Murphy and some other, you know, like
a sidekick. Like,
you one without the other would not be.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
Well, one funny thing too is that there was a TV show of it out of England, and the guy who plays Bertie Wooster is Hugh Laurie?
Hugh Laurie, yeah.
Like the house actor, which is so funny because he became so famous as the kind of crabby guy from House, and I only watched the show kind of funny because he's totally like a dingbat. You know, silly person.
It's so funny because what's so funny for all the Brits is that he then went on to play House, because for all of us, he was just, as you say, the dingbat.
Yeah.
So the idea that he would be taken seriously as a professional, I mean, I suspect Hugh Laurie had to come to America in order to make that move, because I don't think he'd have pulled it off back home. He was so endearingly the, you know, big-eared idiot who'd been on TV for so long playing that character. It was kind of an indelible move, and it's a real testament to him that he pulled off the House so well.
It probably confirms the British's worst opinions of Americans. You know, you can like Hugh Laurie as a serious guy.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it went there. So as a kid, were books then a place to hide? Were they a place to escape? Or was it just that rough year in Michigan? Were they always a place of refuge?
I don't think all this refuge per se, but I guess I like that whole aspect of reading that is, you know, time kind of is much more languorous if you're reading, and it's like dure, you know, they call it, the 19th century idea, that it's just sort of, you're going through this book, you know, and that might be like a couple days. If it's summer and you have nothing else to do, it might be a week or two. And so I think, you know, you had, in the 70s or whatever, you had more time on your hands if you were a kid. Mm-hmm. So I would read a lot, you know, after school or in the car. And, you know, it's also is a distraction. Like, it's, you know, we mm-hmm. didn't have iPads or whatever. So sure. it's kind of like fun to be immersed in an exciting story. Mm-hmm. But as a general, because of that, I guess as a general practice, it's still kind of like my fun time, mm-hmm. you know, and I think it was then too. So mm-hmm. I got really into stuff like Henry James by the time I was in high school because of that too. Like I love those really crazy long sentences, mm-hmm. you know, that are beautiful, kind of thoughtful, probably like unendurable to some people, but I yes. kind of found them very like beautiful and almost not spiritual, but kind of not relaxing, but just very thoughtful. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of, yeah, I guess the crafting of the prose is really an art form separate from the plot. Mm-hmm. Like I would say I agree with that. And I mm-hmm. kind of, I read plenty of stuff that isn't like that and it's plot driven, but I do actually really like things that are artful in the mm. way that they're written.
So Henry James, that was the next, was that the next book that you, in terms of the chronology of the books
so.
That you picked?
Because yeah.
your next book, one of the books that you picked was Wings of a Dove.
Oh yeah.
Which is published in 1902. And I was delighted to see this. I did this podcast. I had my producer interview me for the end of season one. And one of my five was Portrait of a Lady. So
oh, right.
I'm a huge James fan and did my thesis on him at Oxford. So
oh, really?
I know him well. Yeah.
Oh,
and
wow.
and I'm with you. I think those sentences can be unendurable and at the same time are just so magical, so extraordinary. And I think the late James is all about, is sort of let go of plot in a way, and is all about interiority and mm-hmm. and rendering somehow on the page the actual experience of what it is to have a thought. I think sometimes that's where the sentences get convoluted and move, and then you suddenly get to the end and realize that either something has happened or absolutely nothing's happened, but or that you've moved in time, and that where they're processing that, you know, the prospect of something by the end of this long sentence, it has already happened. And I think that's I don't know, I have a theory that that's him wrestling with actually putting consciousness on the page in this really ambitious and brilliant way.
Well, that's one of my favorite short stories of James, which I didn't really come across till later. I mean, I was a big high school, college fan that kind of, you know, you read all the books, right? Mm-hmm. I read them again, but is a story called The Jolly Corner.
Yeah.
The story? Oh my God. So yeah.
I haven't read that for years.
Well, it's just so amazing because it is about that consciousness in a way, and it's the idea that the person, the character, had moved to Europe like James did, and then had moved back to like his family house. I think maybe someone had died or something, and that he's there and he's just sort of haunted, and he thinks that there's a ghost. He doesn't really know what's going on. Like, he just keeps having these eerie things happen in his own house. And it turns out that he's being haunted by the him that he would have been had he not left. You know, so he's got this double consciousness of like him sort of returning expat, and then the person that wasn't there. And it's kind of scary. Like, mm-hmm. it's a scary ghost for him. And it's such an interesting, you know.
Isn't it a great idea, isn't it?
Yeah, amazing conceit. And also you can kind of see how, you know, a lot of us have that. You know,
do you have that? If you go back to the East Coast, do you feel like, is there a version of you that stayed behind there?
Well, I'm very drawn to parts of the places where I had lived before, like in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or I go every summer to Rhode Island, to the same place I used to go as a kid.
To Block Island.
Yeah. I love Block Island. So I would say the power of that place and the buildings on it, and the, you know, I'm disappointed when the farm no longer has cows, you know, like that kind of stuff. But it isn't, I don't think it's just nostalgia. I think it's a kind of I think it's from, because it was a place that I could be very happy and relaxed. Mm-hmm. It kind of is a real return. Like when you do those exercises, you know, when you have to kind of like relax your brain, you have to think of like a happy place.
Sure.
Like that's kind of where that goes. So, mm-hmm. but I would say I've also brought a ton with me from stuff that I liked about mm-hmm. like historic architecture in New England, mm-hmm. or the way that the 70s dealt with color in the context of old buildings. You know, like a lot of that has come with me and is a big part of my work, which is, I would say, not noticeable to someone who's from here, because it's gone through so many weird filters, you know?
Right.
But yeah, so I feel like very, you know, very connected in that way, that I, but what I do is kind of very much an extension of, you know, where I come from.
Right. What age did you know you wanted to be an architect?
12.
Really?
Very early. Yeah, I think I was first a pilot, then I would be a chemist, like 6th and 7th grade, and then I switched to architecture by 8th grade.
And what made that choice?
I think it must be that I babysat for so many architects at the time. And
oh,
I started,
really?
Like, reading.
At 12, you were babysitting?
That, you were tired from babysitting by the time you're 13. That's,
oh,
super.
My,
like,
Lord.
Then you have a real job after 13. Like, we all had, you know, we worked in stores by the time we were 14. But yeah, like, babysitting was like kind of 11, like 11, 12, 13.
So you babysat for architects and therefore were in interesting spaces?
Yeah, their houses were always like kind of weird. You know, they often have, you know, like, I remember, someone would have like, you know, a super graphic, I would say, like, attic in really big yellow letters on the stairs up to the attic that had been sort of turned into, like, a modern rec room or something.
Uh-huh.
Like, that is so cool.
Uh-huh.
Someone else had, like, this slate countertop kitchen that was just, you know, nothing. My family didn't make that, stuff like that. So,
right.
And then, but then the big thing was I just started reading architecture books a lot, like, at night when I was babysitting, because, you know, it's been, like, late night on the weekends, kind of. There's only so much Fantasy Island you can watch, so I remember very distinctly some of the architecture books I would read, and I just got really interested in it. Like, they're even more on the weird side, you know, like, I remember reading The Five Architects, which is this...
That was one of the
70s. Is it on my list?
Yeah, it was on your list.
Well, that's a later.
Oh, that's
five.
A different one. Later Five. Tell me about
the Five one is Peter. Oh gosh, if I'll get it right, but Peter Eisenman, Richard Meyer, Charles Blathmey, John Haydock, and Michael Graves are the five, and they are all doing. This is like early 70s. I think Philip Johnson wrote the intro, and they were all young architects and avant-garde architects who are bringing Corbusier back, basically.
Uh-huh.
And they're doing these abstract drawings of these abstract houses that are kind of like white curves and, you know, some of the Corbusier elements, but sort of put together in almost a more cubist kind of way, and very much about the drawings, not so much about the buildings. And it wasn't necessarily that I was enamored per se of those buildings. I was just so interested. This is something that people were doing, and like, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
And then I had like a big interest in Corbusier for a while and different stuff. And I interned, you know, in high school for some architects.
Were you good at drawing? Were you a gifted artist? Was that something that you brought to it?
I think I was probably more in the art. I like to make stuff, so I would like make boats to float in the fountains at the, you know, near my grandmother's house. I would like assemble things.
Mm-hmm.
I made like a little farmyard when I was little, and, you know, different. I just sort of like to do that, almost more like, let's say, dioramas or something.
Right.
So
right.
And then I don't know that I did study art, and I did in college. I did do as a painter. It was my thesis project, just like that. But I kind of. I wasn't like the person who could, you know, whip out a amazing portrait of, you know, the neighborhood, whatever.
Right.
Lasers or something like that. So, so it wasn't that I was probably more like a constructor of little worlds.
Fabricator. Right. But how extraordinary what happens then, now that you had sat for architects. I mean, I'm curious what would have happened if you'd sat for chemists, whether you'd have reverted back to chemistry.
Once I realized that you had to be in a lab all the time, I don't think this is... I think I thought it was like alchemy, you know, when I was younger, like make amazing things sizzle and those. I mean, I'm sure it is to some degree for chemists, but it wasn't... didn't seem that...
Yeah.
I think I took a chemistry class. But yeah, I don't know. I can't imagine what else I would have been, really. So, I mean, other than maybe an academic, but I never like writing.
You know, you didn't? I was about to ask. You never wrote? No.
No, I don't like, I mean, I have to a little bit, but it's not my thing. I think my family, I also inherited, along with P.G. Woodhouse, a general fear of writing. That
oh, really?
Not a good thing if you're at the parish. So, like, since literally almost everybody in my father's side is an academic, like, some of them would become prolific writers and publish all the time and become wildly successful superstar academics, and some of them would never actually be able to, like, finish writing that one book, and then, you
that
know,
was it.
And it's really dire, you know, and it causes a lot of anxiety, and it's really caused by anxiety, so I think my mom claims that she used to whisper in my ear as a baby, like, don't become an actor. She was probably pretty adamant.
Job done. That's so funny. I wonder if at some level you misheard it and heard become an academic and architect.
She still says it now. She still does.
It's
like, oh, thank God.
That's so funny. So of the architecture books, which is the because you had two that I obviously did not know, but I was fascinated to read about. Which one, sort of, in terms of your chronology, is the next one that you landed on? I have Complexity and Contradiction in Architecture by Robert Venturi and Five California Architects by Esther McCoy.
Well, I guess Complexity and Contradiction, I think we could do that one later because it's Five California Architects is this amazing intro to I don't know if it's the golden age because it still keeps having one, but it was sort of the first golden age of California architecture where it really, Esther McCoy is this wonderful writer and journalist who I think interned for Schindler for some reason. I don't really know why, but she worked in a studio.
Yeah.
And she would maybe a little bit like an Ada Louise Huxtable, you know, without as big a platform. Mm-hmm. And she wrote these really caring portraits of these architects and their work that I think it must have been something they gave us to read early on in grad school, and they I hope they still do in California. I bet they don't though, because it's like
you were in grad school here or the East Coast?
I actually was in England, which is where I was reading Wings of the Dove, and the people there were, this was in the late 80s, and they were like, if you really want to be an architect and build stuff, you should just don't go back to the East Coast, go to California. And I was like, really? And they're like, yeah, really. We know this because our friends are, you know, the California architects.
I'm just going to pause for 1 second. So what were you doing in England when you read Wings of a Dove? How come you were there?
I was there to go to the AA in London, which is in Bedford Square.
Okay.
And I did a year there, my junior year in college.
Uh-huh.
And I did that because I really, really wanted to be like doing some architectural design. They didn't really have that in college. Mm-hmm. They had an art program that was like studio art. So it seemed like a good idea to kind of get in there and do that.
Well, I don't want to keep jumping ahead. Let's finish talking about the California architects. But you have not been, no, you have been back. You've not just stayed on the West Coast. You have moved.
I moved briefly to the East Coast for like a year, but no, in general, I've been here for like a long time.
Right.
20 years, 30 years maybe.
And so these five California architects, you read that in school here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then I would reread it a lot because I think that my hero of those architects, although they're all wonderful, is R.M. Schindler.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a story, I'm pretty sure it's Esther McCoy who talks about it, the story about how Schindler, who wasn't penniless, but he was sort of like, it wasn't fancy, you know. He had this little beautiful house studio that he built with Neutron. He lived there. And he would drive around in a station wagon with a bunch of 2x4s in the back and would kind of like mess around with his stuff that was under construction. So a lot of what's so wonderful about California, about Los Angeles architecture, a lot of the most famous things out here are, you know, single family houses, and they're often quite small. They're really like these intricate works of art, kind of sculptural jewel box, whatever you want to call it, but he had this particular idea about space and kind of organized a lot on these diagonals. He had worked for Wright for a long time when he first got here. And anyhow, but so there was a sense of improvisation, and once you are actually under construction, you can kind of keep fiddling with stuff. And I think that's what, you know, that's what you see in early Gehry stuff. That's what Morpheus was doing when I first moved out, like in the 80s and 90s, like, or Frank Israel has since passed away. Like, there is a kind of a much looser approach and more artistic approach, really, to making space and making buildings in the West Coast. And you know, because the East Coast was tended to be, you know, kind of European influence, you know, building for the ages. And where I grew up in Boston, like, every new building was covered in brick, like, even if it was just a veneer of fake brick. But it was kind of a de rigueur conservatism that we really.
And so he would drive around with the 2x4s in his car, and he'd just go up to sites that he was working on?
His own ones, yeah. It would be, he would, I mean, I think he would.
Yeah, I assumed his own will. Yeah,
he was. I think basically in those days you would often be sort of architect. You wouldn't be the builder, but you just sort of work in the field with the builder. Mm-hmm. Like it wasn't the plans were drawn and everything, but it wasn't handed over and check in once a week. It was mm-hmm. a little more hands on, which is actually still the case. I mean, we do a lot of residential work too, and mm-hmm. you're kind of around a fair amount. Mm-hmm. And, you know, suddenly you're like, oh God, this window is just here, and like you kind of look at the drawings, but we make it here and not mess with the geometry. And if you can, you do because you want to just take advantage mm-hmm. of, you know, things that show up when suddenly you're, you know, 25 feet up in the air, you start to see things that you wouldn't have necessarily seen before.
Do you think that kind of organic responsiveness could happen on the East Coast now that we're in a different time? Or do you think the East Coast just is that much more rarefied and structural and rigid and
well, I guess, I mean, there's, you know, I'm not necessarily implying that the psychology of the whole East Coast is like that, but it's more that those cities were built already, you know, they were kind of done before the 1920s, say, mm-hmm. or something. And so there's so much context that it's harder to feel sure. loosey-goosey, you know. Yeah. And I think the West, because so much of it was built after 1950, literally, mm-hmm. or even 1960 mm-hmm. or 70, like, still half the city was like empty and, you know, it's been sort of filled in that there isn't a whole set of rules to live by. You mm-hmm. know, sometimes you'll see a tract development where stuff looks alike, but often you just sort of, these things are kind of like poked into a little hill here or there. Mm. So there's a freedom from context that, yeah. that helps. And then I think the clients also are more interested in like a unique form of self expression yeah. more often than they are with like a predetermined status, you know.
Agreed. Kind of yeah. conformity. Yeah. You know. Yeah. I found that moving here from London, I was absolutely floored by the architecture here. I mean, I think at the beginning I was snoozy about it because I didn't understand it, because I understood serried rows of
right.
Chelsea, Fulham, you know, houses built for the workers who were building the bridges that, you know, have since become sort of $4 million houses. But, you know, but that and the history of England and of London in particular, just how hodgepodge it is in this melting pot of a, you know, 15th century pub next door to a soaring skyscraper. So I was a snoot about LA's architecture when I got here, and I remember sort of taking photos of some of the particularly craziness in Beverly Hills, where you've got like sort of faux Disney-fied cottage next to, I don't know, a Spanish villa next to
French Tudor.
Yeah, exactly. And then I'm so glad that I've been here long enough to lose that and to just feel kind of delighted at the freedom and the imagination that allows for this. And in the same way, and it's not a dissimilar thing to books, like in the same way that, you know, I've been doing this podcast and people have talked to me, have brought about the graphic novel that meant so much mm-hmm. to them, or the sci-fi, or the Henry James, or the Book of Poetry, or, you know, whatever it is. And in the same way that all is literature, that all counts. This all counts as architecture. This all counts as an expressiveness and in a way of claiming space and putting your own stamp on it in a way that London architecture, it's all I can speak to, doesn't allow for at all. Mm-hmm. You make your interiors yours, but you don't mess with the exteriors at all. And that feels, I don't know, like a fun, it's been a fun thing to watch my experience of architecture grow, or my definition of it expand more since being here, I think.
Introducing Bluehost Cloud. Ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
Yeah, I think, well, the rap on LA for a long time, up until fairly recently, was, you know, kind of kitschy, you know, disposable everything mm-hmm. that was, and superficial and those kind of things. And yet, I would say 20th century architecture, like most of it is in LA, and right. most of the progressive stuff of certainly the late 20th century is from LA. Mm-hmm. You know, the two American Pritzker Prizers are LA
right.
or LA architects. So it's a kind of it's part in a way of the of that re-evaluation or redefinition of LA as maybe more of the cultural, you know, slowly the cultural center seems
yes.
to be moving to LA, you
yeah.
know, jumps from New York, from California,
yeah.
you know, it's sort of a, you have that shift, certainly the art world, you know, you see, like even Kathy Opie did like a wonderful photographer, did a great series of photographs of those kind of houses in Beverly Hills,
uh-huh.
kind of, and they're not in the satirical way,
right.
it's kind of like about their expressiveness, because they
yes.
are like portraits,
yes.
you know, maybe it was a woman in 1968 who that was her, you know,
that was her dream.
Friend
yes,
or whatever, but
exactly.
that was, you know, that's one kind of thing. And,
yeah.
and then I think also, but what's nice is that, yeah, you might have all these sort of more typological style things that are kind of not necessarily in architectural, the capital A
mm-hmm.
land, but yeah, you might also have a fair amount of that mixed in it. In a way, it makes space for, you know, avant-garde ideas.
Yeah.
And I think a more democratic and sort of inclusive, you know, sense of place. Like,
I agree.
Less conformist.
I totally agree. I think that was what I came to. I think that's what I came to sort of appreciate after took some time, but also took some time, I think, to sort of get to know the different enclaves of LA and see to realize this collection of villages that this huge city is, and was something that took a little while to land on. I think having been born and raised in London. That I think I kept looking for the city. I kept looking for Soho or mm-hmm. I don't know, Hyde Park. I kept looking for a center that I could that would hold me in mm-hmm. some sense. And I think, and I lived in West Hollywood at the time for years before I moved up into Laurel Canyon. And I think when I moved up into the hills, I had this realization of like, oh, you can't look to LA to give you an urban experience in the way that London offers it. You have to play to its strengths, and what LA does extraordinarily is offer you this canyon life, I think, that the hill life of these winding little streets and these completely discursive cul-de-sacs that end in nothing, and these hidden cabins and this leafy withdrawal but then seconds later you're emptied out into the Chateau Marmont and or the valley or, you know, whatever it is, that the hills and the beach, I mean, this is just my preference, but I feel like those two extremes are what LA does so beautifully, and that if you surrender searching for your New York or your London pavement walking, pounding experience, I guess downtown these days, that's you can find that. But that had been, it's my advice to young actors when they land here is hit the hills or hit the beach, but stop looking
yeah.
for London.
Right. Well, I think that's what, and I mean, I think of like, say, you know, Rustic Canyon, which mm-hmm. has these beautiful modern wood tree houses by Ray Cappy
yeah.
or something, or Palm Springs with like sort of nitre houses and that whole language of, I mean, you have very distinct enclaves, as you say, like within, you know, within the city. I mean, it's actually pretty hard to see much of LA in a short time. It
yes.
takes a long time. My new favorite thing is Pico Boulevard.
Oh, really?
Pico
and what?
I'm missing the LA. I'm missing like Repo Man LA. Because like downtown used to be sort of so, like where happened. I used to work with a theater down there a long time ago.
Oh, which theater?
It was the Wallen Boyd Theater
okay.
and the Actors Gang used to
okay.
be down there.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so we would have rehearsals down there. I mean, I wasn't in the theater. I was like, I don't know, a helper. But we, you know, there was like one rest of Gorky's. It was open late at night. It was just this funny, like, you know, like Berlin, basically. And then you have, but people would live all over the place. And these other, you know, you go meet in West Hollywood at a bar or something. You go. But what I miss is that I always liked the, again, I think of it as hyper-democratic, like the little entrepreneurship sort of mom and pop, you know, like, oh, suddenly there's like three Russian grocery stores and
uh-huh.
there's a nail salon. Isn't it? Like, you know, this different ethnic, not even enclave, it's sort of like...
A little
light,
yes, the valley does, I think, yeah.
But I just like, so sometimes I'll drive, I have a bunch of work sometimes in Santa Monica, and I'll just take Pico back because it's just
uh-huh.
makes me really happy. Like I go by Roscoe's Chicken and Waffles and the weird Swedish shop, and then the, you know,
it's
a couple true. Other things. Like and that, like some of the houses are kind of pink and white and green, and just, you know, it's almost like it's not Nathaniel-esque because that's such a dystopia, but that kind of sense of, you know, small nice homes in this interesting city.
Yes.
That's kind of what I feel like.
No, Pico, it's true. It still has a 50s sort of hominess, domesticity to it. I know what you mean. That's funny. And Magnolia, that's a boulevard you like? If you're in the north?
I think it's, I gotta make it a movie, but it goes on forever. Mm-hmm. But I was teaching for a while at Woodbury University, and sometimes I'd have to go to like a job in Laurel Canyon, and then you go like weirdly just across some big avenue in the valley, like mm-hmm. together. You know, there's no highway way to get there. You have to kind of like, and some of those are amazing. There's like a cowboy and western store of something, and there's, you know, just the strangest restaurants.
Yes.
And I just like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's something about the specificity of it too, like you say, like the cowboy and western. I think I had that when I lived in West Hollywood for a while too. There was these little Russian stores, and I don't speak any Russian. My mum does, weirdly, is fluent in it. And so I would ring home and ask mum to translate if I just needed a lemon. Like, how do I ask for a lemon? I mean, you'd think they'd be visible. But there was something so dear, and that felt very foreign, because in England, people learn English very, very quickly. Yeah. And here you can maintain your language,
right?
And your, yeah, you really can.
You can tie your whole life.
Completely, and somehow get away with it, yeah. So the next book, which would be Complexity and Contradiction or Big Sleep?
Oh, well, I guess Big Sleep in terms of LA stuff. So, I mean, that one, I just wanted to pick out something that was sort of a noir and that's such a great classic. And then this morning I read this crazy article about Big Sleep, like a more academic one, which had to do, well, I'll get that. But the Big Sleep, it's hard to separate for me anyhow, the film from the
thing. Uh-huh.
It's like a
Do you remember when you read the book?
I read a lot of noir, like, or hardwell fiction in college, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And I watched a lot of noir films, so it was probably kind of tight. I think I liked, that was one of the things I liked about California before I came here, was the whole noir, you know, world. Uh-huh. Detective stories and kind of bootleggers and, you know, what's the classic movie, Chinatown,
mm-hmm.
that kind of stuff. And I still love that, and it's interesting because it's definitely changed, like, my sense of that, because that's a little bit of like a reductivist, like, outsider view, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I think what's so great about noir stories is that they really also add a lot of depth, I think, to people's perception of California, because again, if everyone thinks of it as sunshine and superficial bikini stuff and, well, you know, that everyone's just an airhead or something, versus noir is, you know, dark, gritty, matricide, or, you know, like, mm-hmm. all kind of just, mm-hmm. you know, wars over money and kind of corruption. And what happens in those novels and in The Big Sleep too, it's like the protagonist kind of drives around this big city or collection of towns, and, you know, they're in this super sunshiny street, but like inside there's like a dead body, you know, like it's this mm-hmm. darkness of the lightness of suburbia.
Sure.
So it's almost, you know, whereas there's that other version of noir, I guess it's kind of like urban and like New York downtown, mm-hmm. and like tenements and stuff. The California one is really uses that counterpoint,
light,
of the
dark,
lightness
yeah,
in the
sure.
dark. And I really love that as even a cultural technique, you know, for mm-hmm. an architect to use.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of use these contrasts in terms of how you design. And also it does add a lot of depth to one's perception of, like, well, as an architect, how people might perceive something. Because mm-hmm. someone might be designing something to be blah, 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 but someone else might see it as, like, terrifying for
right.
such and such a reason. And that,
right.
and you can't control that, but you can, I think the more aware you are of multiple readings is a really important skill to have. If you want to
sure.
have, like, successful, especially for public spaces, that you're not, and, you know, sometimes you're just something completely clueless, and you're like, oh my God, like, every person is going to think this is that. but really more, I think, in a profound, like, even like the whole Manson murder, which, you know, something happened around here, like, it's just sort of like there's always this underlying, like, no matter how many palm trees or, you know, 80 degree days, it's full of humans, and there's all these other, you know, there's all kinds of undercurrents there, and it kind of helps us keep in touch with our humanity, I think.
Yeah,
you know?
That's really interesting. I listened to your that fantastic TED talk you gave. I really enjoyed it. And it's a TEDx talk that you can find on YouTube. And you talked about that, about the correlation or the relationship between sunshine and smog, and that this was such an important part of your...
Oh, yes, smog.
Yeah. And I was really struck by it, and then I hadn't got your list yet. And then as soon as I saw The Big Sleep, I felt like, oh, that's closed the circle for me. That made complete sense that this would be something you were drawn to. When did you last reread it? Do you know?
I think I read it like maybe 4 years ago. Uh-huh. But what I... So the interesting thing about it, and it's sort of along the same lines, is, I mean, the thing that I was reading about today is that I guess there was a famous sort of Toni Morrison essay about how, you know, African Americans were kind of written out of a lot of American fiction. Mm-hmm. That's written by white writers, but also that their presence and the presence of slavery kind of like undermines this idea of, you know, American fabulous
supremacy,
land, equality,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, sure.
Which is that, like, we're so equal and democratic, and I forgot that we still slave people. And then, and so the academic who was writing this piece about Chandler that I was reading, and I think about The Big Sleep, was talking about the family in The Big Sleep is actually they're descended from the kind of Mexican aristocrats that were originally like running California. And there's a whole reverse kind of thing that happened. The academic accuses Chandler of being an operative in this, who I think Chandler was kind of a racist Anglophile, and that he would inevitably make characters of color or like Hispanic descent kind of, you know, corrupt or kind of morally
suspect,
degenerate,
whatever, right.
And that this whole family that seems to be like a rich, you know, pillar of society family, it turns out like every single one of the two daughters are supposed to be damsels in distress are actually like horrible, and like one's murdering people, and like, you know, but there's all these clues that they are actually like, you know, mestizo Americans because
interesting
traditionally, I guess, you know, the landed, sorry, that the people who were the kind of rulers of California who were of Spanish and Mexican descent often would sort of intermarry the Anglos after the Mexican-American War in order to kind of keep their property there. Mm-hmm. And like they would essentially be providing the money. They're like the dowry people,
right,
to the whites who are
keeping the bloodline.
Political.
Right, yeah.
So the interesting thing is that instead of writing out like the African-American slave, the job of this kind of racism in fiction is to kind of have an excuse for why they are no longer, you know, why the Anglos or the whites run California, like,
right,
that these people were, it's kind of like when people wrote about the decadence of Rome, they have all kinds of ridiculous
theories,
excuses about sexuality, and
right,
these are the reasons that fell apart. They're like, well, these, you know, because of their inherent decadence, they no longer... The true owners of
the... That's so interesting.
Rivals.
I had no idea until I was researching this, because I read The Big Sleep. When I moved here 18 years ago, I decided to read only California novels for a year and just try and sort of immerse a bit. Well, I just felt so English. I felt so irreducibly English when I arrived, and felt all this dissonance of we all speak the same language, and yet I feel so foreign. I've never felt so alien. And I remember saying to my mom at one point, it would be easier if everyone spoke German, because then I would expect there to be I would expect us to be foreign, you know.
Yeah.
But because we all speak English, there's an assumption of parity and of shared humor and of shared history and shared cultural references. And still 18 years later, I am still unpacking that stuff. I am still like, oh wow, no, I don't get what it is to have been, I mean, who does, but I don't get what it is. The African-American situation here is just not what we have at home. And, you know, I come from a colonial country with its own host of problems, but we didn't have slavery. And that's just not something that I'm still learning about. I'm still educating myself. Anyway, this is a long way off track, but Chandler was someone that I read as soon as I got here. And I remember just sort of falling in love with the world of it and the writing of it, and hungry for what felt like the romance of it and the possibility of it. I mean, even with the darkness, it just felt like every corner Philip Marlowe drove down, there was murder happening and there was a glamorous woman in an evening dress. And
right.
I felt like I would open my door and sort of wander down to my Russian supermarket and wait for something to happen that felt like it belonged in The Big Sleep or any of his novels, but it never did. It never really
did. Well, that's
did.
Lucky in terms of the murder part.
Yeah, I'm glad the murdering part didn't happen. There was a little quote that I found that I thought was so wonderful, and it was interesting because it was just this interesting, it struck me because of what you were talking about, the light and dark, and mm-hmm. what he does with language that is, I think, overlooked because we're so caught up in the plot. But I think Raymond Chandler is really a master of detail.
Didn't he go to Oxford too?
Atmosphere. I don't know if he went to Oxford. He went to Dulwich, interestingly, which is where Woodhouse went. They went to the same school. And I'd not know that he was English, and all that, you know, he was born
in
America.
Nobody does. I mean, that's what's so interesting.
That was amazing.
He's just predates you by a bit.
Anyway, I'll just read you this bit. He describes a room as being too big, the ceiling was too high, the doors were too tall, and the white carpet that went from wall to wall looked like a fresh fall of snow at Lake Arrowhead. There were full-length mirrors and crystal doodads all over the place. The ivory furniture had chromium on it, and the enormous ivory drapes lay tumbled on the white carpet a yard from the windows. The white made the ivory look dirty, and the ivory made the white look bled out. The windows stared towards the darkening foothills. It was going to rain soon. There was pressure in the air already. And I just love that, isn't it?
Wow.
For the white and the dark and the sense of just ominousness and the foreboding, and just in one paragraph, and all he's done is describe some furniture and some curtains in a room. And I was like, that's a master right there. And we can get distracted by Bogie and Bacall being so sort of mesmerizing in their own performances, and what a great movie that was, and what a love letter to LA that was. And yet that just that paragraph alone for me is like, there's why he belongs in the list of, you know, best books and things. It was really something.
Well, that makes me think of that, just the issue of atmosphere, which is kind of what I always try and tell, well, I try to convince the people that work for me here that, like, this, we really are designing atmospheres, because in the end, that's kind of like how people perceive space. I mean, maybe not when it gets to like public space or bigger buildings, but even then, you really want to, it's a little bit, you know, there's a little bit of production design involved, mm-hmm. and there's really, though, a sense of this thing, whatever the school or something, you know, might feel this way, whereas, mm-hmm. you know, this house over here might feel this way, and this might over here, you know, that sort of acute descriptiveness of that is so wonderful, because it kind of shows how much atmosphere matter, you know, that it really can enhance or detract from, you know, whatever the other intention is. It's sort of the opposite of minimalism,
right?
You know, like I'm perfectly happy with minimalism in many things, but I don't necessarily. I think these days as architects, we have to work harder to make people feel like they are in some space, you know, because there's so much crappy junk space around that mm-hmm. you have to do a little more, like, to create an atmosphere, frankly, so that, you know, just as a counterpoint to, say, Instagram. Trust me,
it's so interesting.
You want to make a really immersive environment.
And you think that's harder to do these days?
No, I think you have to do it now. I think that for a long time, you know, minimalism has been the kind of main form that most serious architecture takes, mm-hmm. but I think that is actually changing quite a lot, and maybe partially the digital thing, or maybe just an awareness of all the tools that we have at our hands mm-hmm. as architects, whether it's color or material, that why not use them? Like, why follow the mm-hmm. white on white on white on white rule? Mm-hmm. And, you know,
but it's such a hallmark of your buildings, are these beautiful, they're like patches of sunlight, the color that you use. I love the, there's always seems to be, I mean, not always, but from what I've seen, there's always a patch of yellow that's so sort of sucks you in, or the lovely yellow tiles that you use. And I am all about color when, you know, judiciously used. I think it's gorgeous. I think it's, were you always a colorist, for lack of a better word?
I think it's about, you know, developing, you know, a vocabulary. I think color and even pattern is a lot cheaper as a technique for making architecture than, you know, materiality. Mm-hmm. Like, you can just go, like, I'm going to make a giant, you know, cast terracotta something like
sure.
that. It's going to cost $1 million. Uh-huh. Whereas, like, I could paint something
uh-huh.
terracotta. So it's a inexpensive way of doing stuff, but I think it also does go back to, like, kind of having an interest in, like, painting and different kinds of palettes, even really sort of signify different things
mm-hmm.
in the world, like abstract expressionism, say, versus Paul Klee or Marimekko fabrics or something like that. Like, I like a lot of those different kinds of things that are more slightly exaggerated, high contrast color and pattern.
Makes me think of that with your last book, Complexity and Contradiction in Architecture by Robert Venturi, who the only quote I knew about him was "less is a bore," which which I loved. I really loved. Tell me when you came to that book, or why, or what made it formative, or what makes it formative.
Well, it's one of those books with whom a lot of great people of my generation would have a kind of a love-hate relationship, I think, because in a sense, I started when I was very young. Postmodernism was still at its kind of zenith, and that was stuff like, you know, the literal kind of taking of classical motifs and sticking them on buildings, like the Portlandia building in Portland is kind of famous. And I think I've never actually talked to the writers, but like, I think that the name of that show being named Portlandia, it has to do with that.
Oh, really?
It's like a ridiculous building in Portland. Everybody, it has like very little windows. It has this funny shape, but it's, you know, it was an epitome at the time of postmodernism. And so I hated that. I didn't mind like weird neo-expressionist stuff out of Japan, but I didn't like this whole kind of cut and paste neoclassical thing. So then when I was in school, a lot of us eventually gravitated. Let's say I'm the same era of like, you know, grunge rock and early hip hop, in terms of when I was an architect, started became an architect. Neo-modernism sort of became the de rigueur style, and that is our language, and that is a fairly minimalist language, and things are more stripped down and maybe a little on the boring side, to be honest. So I think when I started working, I would kind of do stuff more like I would deconstruct stuff a little bit. Like, I think one of my first houses had these panels on the side of windows, and there'd be like a sort of a window over what was essentially the wall with the insulation in it, as well as like the window above it. So there's a sort of idea of like, you know, like those agricultural colleges will cut like a circle and a cow and have a window in the cow and see how they digest or something.
Right.
Some sort of teaching tool, but it was kind of like that, like the digesting cow approach to architectural construction. And I thought that was, you know, it was sort of interesting, but like a little more like clinical.
Sure.
And then I really changed over time, and I think partially it was motherhood and having these kids who are like into like all kinds of wild outfits and colors and, you know, trying to go with it and have fun with it. And I started doing, I had like this house that had this giant pink wall in it, and then I kind of
Is that the cabin that you did? No, not the one that you built for yourself.
Yeah, the one I did for myself, I think. Yeah, and the girls, like, that's in the book, I guess. And then I kind of started to go down that path, and the book was in a way taking that idea and like looking back at 20th century LA architecture, looking for that precedent, because it was, you know, it's very exuberant. Like, the Schindler houses are kind of crazy. Yeah. Like, Frank Lloyd Wright's doing like bananas, you know, pink curvy houses with round windows, and then Albert Frey, like all these different people. So I was really loving the fact that actually modern history is not hygienic and antiseptic and kind of, you know, everything must be more minimal like Mises would have done.
Sure.
And instead, it's actually this kind of wild bunch of imaginations and forms. And I loved like the Gehry, that early Gehry. Like, so it seemed to me there was more of this continuum, and that I needed to bring to the public the fact that actually modernism is like this. It doesn't, it's not that. It is like, there is a more is more modernism. And I've kind of just worked, you know, I haven't worked on that in a proselytizing way per se, but I do feel that way, that it's, you know, architecture can be, you know, quite, it's really fun to do. And if you make a good space, people really want to be there. So that, and then that, again, as in the same time frame as like, as this digital realm has really grown, I really feel like it is not a fight to the death, but you really are fighting for attention.
Yes.
There's just, it's hard to compete with like constant, you know, ads and programs and notes from your friends and snap, you know, all these things on your phone. So, and I guess I do enough retail and restaurants. Like, I know that if I make it really a place people want to be, then it helps them like meet other people. You know, they talk to the person next to them. They might still be like writing their screenplay on their computer, but then they might end up having these different relationships, and it becomes like hospitable for human interaction.
It's an important one
because it's again, but you have to use different.
I say it's setting the bar so high. I think it's something you you do so beautifully. I mean, the Intelligentsia coffee shop in Silver Lake, to listeners who come to LA, go to it, because it is not only a wonderful cup of coffee, but it is an invitation to stop for a moment. It really is. There is so much space in there. I remember being bewildered when I first walked in and thinking, why is there so much space? Why am I not being herded? Why am I not being confronted by, you know, the conventional bar at which I must sit, but I can walk all around this space. I can interact with these baristas anywhere. I can interact with the other people. I mean, as a result, I think Intelligentsia probably resents you because people just sit there and write and hang out all day long. I mean, I say resent with a smile, obviously, but I think it's something you do, and I think it's an amazing thing to take so seriously as a sort of civic responsibility, is to encourage people to look up, just to look up and look out at the space that they're in. And I think your spaces do that. They really do.
Thank you. That means a lot. Well, that's
really something. I have some follow-up questions. Can I ambush you with some of them? What almost made the list but didn't?
Oh, God. Oh, I have a long list. Well, there was... I read this book that really affected me a lot, like maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and it kind of predated, like, the way that Trump really, I think, woke up a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It's, like, the kind of larger history of institutional racism and sexism and stuff. And it's this wonderful book. What is this? Goddamn, it was something like The Incident at Gainesville. It's by a African-American historian / writer in Oregon, Daniel. Oh, gosh, I'm going to not even...
Don't worry.
But what it is about, he's got a kind of a character, probably like himself, as like an academic who goes back to see his father who's dying in like this tiny town in Georgia, but it's kind of, you know, like the UN guy was just going around America looking at poverty, and he's like in rural Georgia, and there's places where it's kind of like sewers kind of like on the surfaces, and it was basically like one of those places. Mm-hmm. But over, like, somehow the book kind of unfolds into like a pretty searing history of his father's father, and who had been sort of a bootlegger but also had been an emancipated slave, and just a very, very thorough, intense portrait, not just of those characters, but then really like all these pretty complex political things around it, and history, like, you know, 19th century American history and 20th century. And I just found it really deeply moving because it was, you know, the writing I thought was good, and the way that it kind of also, I was just learning so much, you know, sort of fact-based stuff in addition. But it wasn't even like historic fiction. Anyhow, so that I thought was a good one, because I feel like there are so many interesting books out now, like the Ta-Nehisi Coates or something like that, but as a fiction reader, like I'd rather go that way where I get like a lot, you know, for, you know, that kind of also has like a story, because in a way also it helps me like remember all the facts more, you know, because that they're sort of tied together into this
group. Retain it better, yeah, me too.
Yeah. So that was a big one. And then the other one, I guess, was Jane Gardam, who I've just like read everything of hers lately.
Oh, which one?
Well, I started with The Old Filth.
Uh-huh.
But I guess I don't know that I would have said that the books, you know, shape me per se, but it's more that I was happy to find like a more recent writer that was also writing that kind of, you know, that was writing about a period that I guess I felt like she was sort of a Henry Jamesy person, you know, of today. Like,
right.
They're kind of profound psychological things.
Yeah.
Deal a bit with the sort of class issues that are part of that, although it's not like the main topic.
Right. What's the book you lie about having read?
Oh, Moby Dick. I probably love Moby Dick, except I never can finish it. So I love like the beginning. I've read the first chapter like 1,000 times, you know, but I'm like, oh. I don't know why I haven't read. I mean, it makes no sense to me. I've read like all of Trollope, which is like way slower than Moby Dick. Somehow not Moby. I think it's the timing issue.
I
love seafaring stories.
I haven't read it. I think I've started it too. I think honestly, for me, it's and I'm not usually bothered by this, it just feels incredibly male. I think part of me feels very, very outside it in that way. Like, I can relate to having something I want passionately, but there's something gendered about it that I can't quite get past, I think. Do you have a favorite movie or TV adaptation of a book?
Hmm.
Maybe it's Big Sleep.
I guess a TV one that I really like, and I was trying to get my husband to watch it. I think that was the Armistead Maupin, Tales of the City,
yeah.
Lauren Linney.
Yeah, oh gosh, I never
I
saw
that.
It.
Oh, it's so good.
I read the books, but I never saw it.
It's not like as high a production value as what you expect these days, but the actors are all quite amazing. Like, I think it's Olympia Dukakis, Lauren Linney, and I just love Lauren Linney. And it's just such a great story about, again, a California story.
Sure.
San Francisco in the 70s. Yeah. And there's just kind of like everybody, I think Armistead Maupin wrote in a kind of Dickensian way where he just like dash off another chapter for the newspaper every week.
I think
week.
That's right. I think
so
it's serious.
Kind of,
yeah.
It's just like anything could happen, you know? But it's not necessarily, like, I think I would always like the film version better probably than if I was actually reading on the page, because I don't really know how the prose quality is, but maybe it's fabulous. But it's a wonderful story, because it's also, like, in a way, a lot of us think of, I mean, when I think San Francisco 70s, I think, like, you know, crazy serial killers and horrible politics and, you know, murdering the mayor and all this stuff.
Right.
And it's a kind of a, it's more like sexual awakening, and like one of the lead characters is transgender that you don't know really, but it's you could almost say like Sessopath or stuff like Transparent.
Right,
like
sure. And a little community. That's what I remember about it.
Yes, they live in this boarding house, which is like my ideal for, you know, retirement.
Yeah.
I don't know where I'd be, like a bunch of people. My friends all live in the same.
I agree. I think we talk about the same. We talk about this all the time, that we need a compound for him.
Yeah.
Or the compound's
totally
the way to go. Thank you so much for doing this. This was such a pleasure. Thank you for being my guest.
This is super fun.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's interview. If you liked the show, please write us a review on iTunes, on the website. It really makes a difference. Rate us, give us some stars, let your friends know, let your family know, tell everyone you can. Go to the website, bookishwithsonyawalger.com, if you want to find out about any of the books that you heard about. We list there not only the 5 favorites, but every single book that is referenced. You can also buy the books through the website, and we make a tiny, tiny little percentage of whatever you buy through the website. So if you are interested, please go ahead and click on that. You can find us on Facebook. We have a Bookish with Sonia Walger page. You can find us on Twitter with @BookishSonia or @SoniaWalger.com. And you could also email me through the info@BookishWithSoniaWalger.com page. If you hit on contact, it'll just automatically pop up as an email there. So if you have any ideas for guests that you'd like to hear from, or thoughts that you have about the show, please don't hesitate to share them there. Thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the show.